Hey, I'm Eric Tornberg, and welcome to another episode of Maker Stories, where we explore what makes the makers, what drives them, what they're scared of, how they make sense of the world, and everything in between. This week's episode is with Sierra DeMolder. Sierra is a renowned spoken word poet who's just released her third book, Today Means Amen. In this episode, we talk about what it means to be a poet in the world today, how a poet makes a living, the craft of writing, editing, performing, and then themes in her work, which include relationships, mental health, shame, humor, and much more. All right, here's Sierra.
Thank you for being our first poet on Product Hunt Live.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Excellent. I thought people would enjoy that. And you know, I've been looking forward to this for a while because I went down the YouTube rabbit hole of your poems 6 months ago, and I thought it was something really special.
So thank you.
Tell me, when was the moment when you first knew that you wanted to become a poet?
Well, backstory, I wasn't a poet in high school. I would write for myself in my angsty high school journal.
What did you think you would do in high school?
I was a visual artist. I went to a high school, a graduating class of like 60 people, and I was the visual artist. I had to paint all the school murals and stuff. And I just thought that's what I was going to go to school for. And then in college, when I discovered poetry, specifically spoken word, it was as if 2D art or painting was a placeholder and my creative energy did a 180. And I always say this, it sounds super cliche, which is bad because I'm a poet, but I say that my poetry is my heart's truest language and I found it then. Yeah, cliche, snap, snap.
Which poem did you make where you first said, oh, wow, I'm pretty good at this?
I've always enjoyed it. It's always been invigorating. Like, that's the word. And I don't want to tell you about my first poems. They were really bad. They were just angsty and young. And I remember I had a poem. I had a line about how I didn't wear a bra at the time. And I thought that was really radical. So I don't want to talk about that. Change the subject. Strike from the record.
That's interesting. Aren't a lot of your poems angsty? Aren't a lot of poems in general angsty?
Yeah, I think it's like the difference between like well-articulated angst. Yes. Angst isn't bad. It's just, yes. You know, the difference is now I have 10 years of experience and professional community and growth and whatever.
Yeah. So how does, you know, there are a lot of aspiring poets, you know, not, like even on the side, people who want to pick it up as a hobby and people who want to, you know, get better at it. You're also a teacher of the craft. Like, how does, besides just doing it, how does one, you know, really get better at poetry?
My first advice for everyone, no matter where you are in the genre or in your experience, is consume your craft. Go read as many poems as you can. Go on YouTube. Check out Button Poetry. Go to an open mic. Open mics can be horrible, but they can also be really amazing. Consume it, because as you sharpen your palate, as you decide what you like and what you don't like, that's how you can emulate it in your own writing. I think that's true of anything. You have to really know your craft to be able to master it.
You know, when I found, you mentioned, you know, Button Poetry. When I found your work, I also found Button, and I just sat through like all the 1,000 videos.
Yeah, I think Button Poetry and Chill is now a thing on Twitter.
That's amazing. So yeah. For those who don't know, talk a little bit about Button Poetry, how you guys started it.
Sure. Button Poetry was started about 5 years ago by myself, Sam Cook, Heidi Lear, and Rachel Cermak. And at the time, we really just wanted to be a distribution company for spoken word. We've seen, you know, we would go to national tournaments or shows and see some of the most powerful poems in the world. And then they would disappear into the ether because they weren't recorded. Originally, we had small goals of just making CDs back then of local teams slam poems or their work and being able to distribute them locally within those communities. However, later, about a year later, I believe Sam Cooke and Dylan Garrity, who later joined our team, won a grant to get a really nice camera, and they went to a national tournament, and they started the YouTube channel, which is really where our focus is now. I've since then stepped away from the inner circle. However, I'm still a contractor with Button and one of the founders. But really what our purpose is now is to produce great quality spoken word material that you can use. If you're a poet, you can use it professionally. Or if you're just a reader or a listener or a writer, you can find it. It's a way to really document this amazing kind of grassroots art form that was fleeting without some of these major recording distribution things like Button or 100 other orgs.
Yeah. You know, it's, it's interesting. If people want to be a musician, there's sort of a clear path in some ways. You know, there used to be like, you know, record labels will sign that. Or there's sort of a surrounding like business infrastructure. Performance poetry as a sort of business is, it seems like a fairly new concept. I mean, you've chosen to make, you know, poetry your career, and there's a bunch of different things you could do. You could be a teacher, you could do workshops. You know, there's a few different ways you could, like, you know, create, make a living from that. How have you, you know, than just performances, how have you thought about how you want to make, you know, poetry your career?
I think you touched on it really well, meaning my career is by no means one thing. I've been describing it lately this year as a collage, or a pie chart, really, you know, where I make, if you think about it monetarily, you know, I think I make half of my income performing, I make a quarter of it teaching, I make 15% through book sales, and then whatever else is left, because I'm not a math person, through various random things. And I like that. I think people, a lot of ask me about being busy. I'm incredibly busy, and I'm also incredibly lucky to be both creatively minded and business minded. I like, my 10-year goal is to get my MFA sometime in there so that I can teach at a college, but I don't even want that to be my full-time job. I love what I do, and I love how organic spoken word is. It's meant to be in the classroom, it's meant to be with young people, and I really think that I can just sort of go with the evolving medium, I guess.
Do you think Button or things like Button in the future will serve as, and record labels is sort of a negative term nowadays because they treat musicians poorly sometimes, but sort of infrastructure to help art poets, you know, tour and sort
of? I think it already has. If you look at the careers of some of the viral poets, people who were virtually unknown before Button, and then their poems get over 1 million views. They have careers built off of that. At least for me as well, even before Button, YouTube was a crucial tool to develop my career before virality or whatever the hell you want to say. It allows me to, because my medium is live, obviously I have this, and this is important, but this is rooted in the live experience. And because of that, YouTube is crucial, and therefore Button, I think, is also crucial for developing that. And I think, if I could guess, we're going to see more of that. We're going to see a professionalized, we already have Verses and Flow, which is a new TV show of spoken word. We used to have Def Jam. I think it'll get more and more mainstream. And kind of like you said, with record labels, there will be pros and cons with that, but we'll see. I think it's good. I think spoken word changes lives, and the more people who are exposed to it, the better.
When you talk to, you know, poet friends and just you in general, do you think that, is there something that's currently missing? Maybe like a show, or like a, is there some outlet that you say, oh, they should just do this and it'll be there?
I'm sure I have felt that way. I can't, what comes to mind is something that's already happening. And I just experienced it truly for the first time on Monday. And I'm not just trying to push Button again, but Button just started doing a local show in St. Paul, where I'm based in the Twin Cities. And what they do is really cool. It's a normal slam, but they live feed it, and we've had upwards of 1,000 people watching it through live feed. And then what's really amazing is the host and myself, who was competing on Monday, we were tweeting with viewers and readers, and that sort of engagement, connecting the poets with their readers and their fans, it was just one of the coolest moments. It's really what I felt like Button has been reaching towards this whole time. And I think that more reader / fan engagement is the better. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. And it's, I mean, a lot of the people, like, a lot of the poets I see are from Minnesota.
We have a really wonderful community here. And also, you know, I mean, not only is Button founded here, but we have a 2-time National Poetry Slam champion team that I was on. And we really built a community that strives for great poems and creativity and community. And I hope we did.
I'm a huge fan of the, of sort of, even before I discovered, but the hip hop scene in Minnesota in general, yeah. Going back
absolutely.
To
absolutely.
I mean, yeah. Idea is like my favorite rapper of all time. I mean,
and it's all connected. You know, Dessa from Doomtree was a spoken word poet before she started rapping. So,
yeah,
definitely a great community. And if there's anybody out there looking for a move, I moved to Minnesota on a whim. Other than the fact that it's freezing and we just got 2 feet of snow yesterday. Other than that, it's a really amazing place for art and culture and poetry.
Wait, tell the
there
story.
There are some social disparities going on, but we're trying to get better.
How did you move there?
I had my heart broken, and I was young and dumb. I moved there on a whim, essentially, because I was young and dumb and heartbroken. And I met some poets. And so it's kind of, what's cool is Sam Cooke, the guy who started Button with me, we met each other within the same week. We both moved to Minnesota within the same week and met each other that week and then went on to start Button. So it's pretty cool.
Do you feel that your poet friends are just wiser than you're not?
No. Let me be clear. Poets are fucking crazy, you know? However, I will say I have some really wonderful, talented friends and community members that surround me. So I have a very high standard for awesome people. Does that mean they're like mentally stable and can pay their taxes on time? Maybe not, but.
How would you compare like poets and comedians?
I think that they're similar, meaning a lot of poems are comparable to monologues or to comedic monologues. We are entertainers. We're both entertainers. We're both storytellers. I would say that the poetry community tends to be a little bit more politically correct and sensitive to social issues. We are, and I say that with pride, you know, being in poetry has made me a better person. Yeah, that's probably all.
Yeah. And that's actually a good, you know, poetry, when done well, makes you a better person. And, well, I don't want to say anything about comedy. Hopefully that does too. let's talk about, well, I mean, the reason I asked that is because a lot of your poems are also funny.
I hope so, a little, yeah. Which is great because I used to be a really dark writer. I'm glad you think that.
I think you contrast, you have strong contrast, which makes it very interesting.
Thank you.
Let's talk about the book. So today means amen. So that's one of your, you know, one of my favorite poems of yours. Why did you call it that?
I actually had nothing to do with it. The publisher, who is the publisher, Andrews McMeel, who is the publisher of Calvin and Hobbes, which for all little nerds like me, super exciting. They approached me, which is phenomenal and hashtag blessed. And they just gave me a book proposal and said, we want to publish this many copies and we want to be titled Today Means Amen. And I didn't totally love it at first, to be completely honest, because I just have a thing for titles, and if they're right, they're right, and if they're wrong, I don't know. But what did I want it to be? I have no idea. It took me forever to name all of my other books. So I'm kind of glad that they kind of like pushed this on me. But also, like, as my career progresses, and, you know, this is my first book on a major press, so it's the first book that will be in all Barnes & Nobles. You know, as I get more professional, the name recognition of that poem is really important too, you know, and so I weighed the pros and cons, and now I love the title. I love the cover. I'm all okay with it now. That's my long story.
Yeah. And so for, you know, all the aspiring poets out there who want to know a little bit more about the publishing process, like, yeah, how does one get approached? Like, did they just see you perform, or did they read your past books or see your YouTube? Like, tell.
Yeah. So this is how everything in my life feels so serendipitous, is that the very quick story of Today Means Amen, the book, starts 7 years ago with a poem called Werewolf about my experience with self-harm and depression. I wrote that poem. It went on YouTube. That made me really uncomfortable. And then I started receiving messages from people across the country. This story is going away from publishing, but I'm going to go with it. So I started receiving messages from people around the world who had found some sort of solace in my poem, in my honesty about my struggles. And then years later, as I became, as my healing process developed, I wrote Today Means Amen, the poem, in response to who I was then and who found solace in my poem, just to say that, like, we've all made it through something, we're here, that is an accomplishment. And then, like, a month later, I said, I want to make a video. I called Dylan Garrity, Button Poetry's assistant director, I don't know his title, and I said, I want to make a video, and they had just won their camera. So we threw together this video with all these great photos that I collected. It was all on a whim. And then 2 years later, the Andrews McNeil approached me and said that they had followed my blog and saw my video and wanted to publish me. Long story short, that was incredibly serendipitous. And where I would get into publishing is just to say, constantly put yourself out there, make opportunities for yourself when they aren't there. I have been incredibly blessed by the opportunities that have come to me, but I also feel like they have been all little baby steps that I've made towards this book was made because of all those little decisions I made to put myself out there. Publishing world in itself can be really elite and exclusive and hard to break into. And I know that can be really discouraging, but just make sure you're moving forward and continually putting yourself out there.
Let's talk about that process. When you first put Werewolf, or when that was first became online, you've had a few poems since then about depression. Talk about that process of not feeling comfortable about it at the beginning, and then how did you get more comfortable?
Yeah, so when that poem went online, it wasn't posted by Button. Button didn't exist. YouTube wasn't the social global tool that it was today. We're talking 7, 8 years ago. And, you know, there's something different about consenting to perform in front of an audience of strangers than consenting to put it online where it's accessible to everyone, your family, your boss, your significant others. And at that time, too, mental health, we're still making continual progress to break down mental health stigmas, saying that you can't deal with depression, that you can't be, that you have to keep these things secret. So at the time, I felt an extreme amount of shame and embarrassment, and I didn't want people to think that I was crazy. And then I started to receive these messages and just saying, I've experienced this too. Thank you for putting your story out there. You know, they talk about eating disorders, parents' relationship, abusive relationship. You know, it didn't matter what I talked about. It was just that I shared myself, and therefore they felt safe to share their story. And I'm not going to lie, that didn't change my feelings right away. Like, that's a powerful, beautiful thing that I've continued to experience in my life. that reciprocal sharing. But I was still ashamed. I was still scared. And it took a really long time and a lot of really beautiful, powerful messages for me to realize that my shame about my like dirty little secret was not as important as what was happening with this, not a global phenomenon, I'm not that big of a deal, but the idea that we were having this mutual sharing and healing experience. And at one point or another, I just had to say, I can't care about this because it's doing good work. And my entire career has been kind of based on that ideology ever since.
It becomes bigger than you.
And yeah, it did. And that's not to sound pretentious. It's just that people say, how can you write about something so personal? And while it is incredibly personal, I don't feel like I'm the only one at stake. I don't feel it's not just for me anymore. Yeah.
And you could tell in the Today Means Amen poem, it's a community poem. Like, it's, you know, it's like you talking.
I hope it is. It was its only joy. Its only purpose was to be for everyone who had ever heard Werewolf, which I no longer perform, and said, that poem is for me. I wanted to say, this poem is for you also. You know, like, this is what you deserve. Yeah.
It's an interesting phenomenon. You just mentioned you no longer perform that poem, and I have other poet friends who had poems that they no longer perform, that the poem exists forever on YouTube.
Yeah, it's weird.
People ask
and that's
you,
what I was saying. I have to stop caring. I have to say, even though this is not of me, even creatively, like the style of the poem, I feel like I have personally surpassed, but it's not of me anymore.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, you were mentioning before a certain shame that goes with, you know, those feelings. Where does that shame come from, you think? Or just shame in general? Shame.
God, that's my next book, actually, if you want.
Really?
I'm going to write a book. No. But I could write a book about it. You know, so much shame comes from our childhood, from the moment we realize, like, we're being watched, or, like, the second you become self-conscious and you know, there's a line in my poem about dancing, but I still use that as an example because I remember dancing like a crazy kid and having fun and being so free in my body and then looking over and realizing that people were laughing at me. And that moment, like, God, what a horrible moment. What the hell? Like, and I think, we have shame about our bodies. We have shame about our worth, you know, like pride, to have pride in ourselves. We have shame about our mistakes, our sex, everything. We're shame filled. And I would love to not be anymore.
But yeah, so I've been interested in depression for a while because I didn't sort of grow up knowing what it was. You know, people don't really talk about it. And then in college, I had a friend who became depressed, and we were like, "Oh, okay. Well, I guess it'll just get better on your own." Like, we had no idea. And then, that friend was very close, and you know, I was like, "Yeah." She took her life.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And then everybody sort of came out and said, you know, or a lot of people said they were, you know, struggling with depression too, and it was sort of this thing that I had no idea what it was. Was it genetic? Was it something people worked through? And so I'm curious, as someone who's, you know, wrote a lot of poems about it and experienced in your life and people, how have you sort of processed what it is and how people can work through it, and you've sort of, you know, made a community around it?
So in my life too, I think I had a similar experience, except for it was internal, the idea of like, why am I unhappy? Why am I not feeling anything? And I think it came to me, how I started to understand it is through community, through my artistic community, through great organizations. I think my personal coming to terms with it was very art rooted and poetry rooted. However, I do want to shout out organizations like To Write Love on Her Arms, or Mother, other like Active Minds, I think is another great one. Just kind of trying to educate people, because that's another one thing is with mental health issues, you feel isolated. And isolation feeds into everything regarding mental health. And so education, and then breaking the stigma, the idea that it's not, it doesn't have to be genetic. It doesn't have to be, it's not your choice to be depressed or schizophrenic, or, you know, nobody's going to choose. Schizophrenic is genetic, never mind. But, you know, it's the idea that, like, we have a normal, happy world and everybody else is on the outside of it. I used to, in interviews, when people would ask me about how, why I would write about such intense personal things, this is before I wrote Funny Work, I would say that there's a spectrum of human emotion, you know, and we focus on happy and joy and pride and glee. But on the other side of the spectrum, there's jealousy and insecurity and anger and sadness and all of these other things. And I think we experience these just as much, if not more, than these feelings. We just normalize these feelings. Right. So yeah, just so recognizing that we are complex beings.
When people ask you if depression is either genetic or something we do to ourselves, is that just a false question, or is there no answer to that question? Or
I think it depends, because you can be genetically predisposed to mental health issues, including depression. And then it also can just be an independent thing caused by the factors in your life or your own personal experience. I think people asking you what causes your depression might not be asking the right question. While that could be the right question in some certain intimate conversations, maybe the first question you should say is like, hey, I'm here for you. How are you doing today? You know?
I mean, after your today means amen, but you must have gotten so many people who that must have spoke to.
If I ever want to cry, I read the comment sections.
Yeah.
It's been really wonderful. It's the response to today means amen will forever change my life.
Yeah. How do you process so many people, you know, sharing their stories with you, you know, and you like not being separate from it in some way? Like,
that's a great question. I consider the people in my life to be broken up into three categories. The first and the biggest is made up of readers and listeners and what people would call fans that I don't really know. And they enrich me in so many ways and give back to me. But at the same time, we don't really know each other. And I give a lot to them because they kind of, they share their personal stuff with me, right? And then the other categories are like people that I love to take care of, who I know intimately, and then people who take care of me, and that's the smallest category, but the most important. It's been really interesting navigating what I've called in casual conversation being a mental health Pied Piper, you know? It's definitely been a journey, because I have conflicting feelings. Number one, I am forever grateful for the connection that people find in my work. It fuels me. It feeds me. It makes me cry. You know, it's beautiful. Just the other weekend, a woman wrote to me and said, "I love listening to your poem. Every time I do, I think about my daughter who I lost to suicide, but I still listen to your poem because I believe in people making it, you know, and that, what have I done in my life to deserve that type of sharing? You know, it's just so beautiful. I'm fueled by it. And then at the same time, it's really heavy. It like,
how are you not crying all the time? I feel like I'm about to.
I literally am constantly, just so you know. Everybody out there who writes me, I read all of your letters and I cry constantly. So there's the other side of the coin is that I'll be out to dinner with my friends and I'll get a message like that. And all of a sudden I'm sucked back into this world, which I'm not complaining about. It's just been really interesting to navigate as I approach 30, you know,
right,
that I've been getting these messages consistently for the past 5 years. Yeah.
And, another theme that you write about a lot is relationships and exes.
Sure do.
one poem I think that I like that shows the contrast between sort of the funny and the serious and sad is the like to the woman hitting on my boyfriend.
Yeah. Yeah.
Will you not perform that one anymore?
I don't. Just because it's out of the cycle. And
right.
I also see, I say the word bitch in it.
Yeah.
I try not to say that anymore.
I think you said it a couple times.
Yeah, I know.
I believe the words are cut a bitch.
Yeah, oh yeah. No, you can say it. I can't.
Yeah,
just kidding.
I say it every morning.
I think I write a lot about relationships too, because when people say like, oh, what do you write about? Which is my least favorite question, so don't ever ask me that. I say like, oh, I write about the human experience, right? And love and loss is so much of that. Even if we're lusting over someone, even if we are unrequited or in the past,
yeah.
That's the most true human emotion is love and all of the shit that comes with it.
So I'm gonna get into that, but first, you mentioned it's a bad question. It is a terrible question. Why is it, it's one of the very interesting questions, why is it such a bad question? Because it's
not a bad question.
It is
an easy question, meaning yeah. It puts all the onus on me to explain the vast catalog of my work in a sentence or so.
Yeah.
And also it implies that I would ever limit myself creatively, you know,
right.
Oh, I only write about women's issues. Oh, or I only write about love poems. It's just not real. Yeah.
And it's sort of laziness on behalf of the asker.
You know, it's a genuine laziness. Like, this is why I lie to people on the plane when I travel, you know, seven
yeah.
months out of the year to do this. And people sit next to me and they're like, oh, are you traveling for business or pleasure? And I say business, hoping they won't ask anything else. And they're
right.
like, oh, what do you do? And I say, I'm an elementary school teacher. And then they don't ask me why I'm traveling. But I lie because it's hard to say I'm a professional poet because people don't see that often.
Yeah.
I don't lie all the time.
Side note, I also just lied a little bit about my job, but I was in an Uber and this guy, the driver was a motivational speaker and he was so inspiring.
Did he tell you he was?
Yes. Yes. And then he practiced his material on me. He said,
wow. See, that would be me being like, hey, I'm a professional poet. You like to be really depressed while you listen
yeah.
to the sad poem. You know, it's a little bit more invasive for a poet. Okay. So, to Mason, when you're working on a manuscript, how do you decide on the order of the poems? So are they ordered by image, set, theme, or subject matter? When I'm putting together a book like Today We Say Men or any of my other three collections, I collect all of the poems that I think I want to be in the piece. I print them all out. I lay them on the floor in an empty room and just kind of go through them piece by piece visually to try to feel the type of transition that a reader might feel. I do think about themes. I do think about repeated images. I try not to have repeated images back to back. I also always think about an arc. There are five sections in this book, and if you don't want to be depressed, read the last section, because I always think about the idea of starting with conflict, or presenting problems, going to conflict, overcoming them, and then survival or something like that. Heidi, can you touch on the tendency for poets and poetry to silo themselves and the perspective of the poetry ivory tower? I will say this. I think that performance poetry and academic poetry, meaning what is published in journals or studied in school, have been at odds with each other in history. However, it's starting to mesh together a little, and any of this weird pretentiousness left over in academic poetry, you know, poetry has always been an aristocratic thing for the educated. It was never for the people, the common person. And I think that kind of snottiness is going away or will be destroyed in the next 20 years because of the fantastic crossover of spoken word poets going into academia and succeeding, you know, winning, you know, think about Patricia Smith. She started out as a performance poet. Dinez Smith, who is a great up and coming spoken word poet, who's also kicking major ass in the academic world. I think the best poems live in a Venn diagram of page and stage, and the best poems are right in the middle. And I think we're going to see more and more of that in publishing and in the world of the ivory tower. That tower is going down, something like that. Okay, how did Alexandra? How do your own experiences go into your writing? I'm kind of a no holds bar. Is that a phrase? Did I say it right? No holds
bar.
Like I don't withhold anything in my writing. I'm very honest. My dad always jokes that he doesn't want to piss me off because he doesn't want to end up in a poem. However, he's in all of them. I don't edit myself in the writing process. However, I do occasionally withhold poems from publishing because they're too close to people's lives or whatever. Emily, what inspires you the most when you're writing? I think earlier in this interview, I talked about how poetry is my heart's truest language. And when I say that, I mean when I hear a line or a song lyric or a monologue, words strung together that make me feel, it's like in my heart. It's like, I don't know, what inspires me is what sticks with me. What in my classes, I often ask people what their favorite thing was from the week. And it could be a text message, a billboard, a piece of art, anything. But what like made you stop and go, you know? And that really, when I think about what inspires me, other than the human experience, it's really that to me, that moment of inhale, of inspiration. And Louise, is there a poem you've ever regretted writing? Oh, for sure. I mean, you have to write a million horrible poems to get to one poem you love. I also love to say that, you know, I'm a big proponent of or fan of editing. And I like to say that I write 10 shitty lines to get to one good one. And then you cut the 10. You gotta kill your darlings to get to the good stuff. And you had to write those lines to get to the good poem. That doesn't mean that they weren't worth any. However, poems that I regretted writing, especially because I am an incredibly personal writer. And before this was an established career for me, you know, there might have been a small handful of times in which like I put too much of my personal life into a poem or whatever. Also, you know, just like the To the Woman Hitting on My Boyfriend poem that Eric brought up earlier, for personal choices, we don't even dig into. I don't say the word bitch anymore, and that's in that poem. You know, so it's little things. We can't expect to love our work forever. That would be irrational. And I've been doing this for almost 10 years now, so I have to. And then I see Transient. How do you get over stage fright and being too naked on the page? Super funny. Great question, because there's the word naked in it. The first time I performed poetry, the night before, I modeled nude for a drawing class, and that was freaking terrifying. And then the next day, I was like, I just got naked in front of strangers. I can do anything. And then I read my poem, and I was like shaking. You just do it. You just have to do it. And generally, most poems are under 3 minutes long, so it's going to be over like that, and it's going to be so worth it. So just promise me you're gonna do it. You'll feel exhilarated afterwards. Practicing really helps. I used to bounce when I got nervous, so my friends made me wear high heels to perform, which is horrible. You know, practicing, going to your open mics, reading in front of your friends, recording yourself on your computer and watching yourself back. There are ways to get over that. And then to be being too naked on the page, don't think about that. Don't think about them as separate things, as page and stage right now. Just write what you need to write. Write your truth, write your art, whatever. And then adapt them to either. Well, they perform there really well, or there are ways to make stage or performance poems look beautiful on the page. Just write what you need to write and then deal with presenting them later. Make sense? I think that's it, except for who pays you to write poetry? just kidding. I make my living off of poetry. I make the majority of my income off of performing at colleges and universities and high schools across the country. I was paid to fly to Germany and perform in Germany and Austria. And then also wonderful things like artist grants. Come to Minnesota, there are hundreds of amazing artist grants here, but there are national writing grants across the country that will fund this, and then hopefully you when you buy my book. Was that threatening enough?
Perfect. I want to ask a couple more questions. So
yeah.
Going back to, you know, a lot of poems being about relationships, you know, some are positive, some are about negative relationships. Why do we get into repeatedly negative relationships? Like, how would you?
You want to know what? I think it's because they bother, you know, I'm from the generations that had to do home ec in high school, and they'll teach us how to freaking sew an oven mitt, but yeah. They won't teach us how to have mature emotional relationships. and they don't teach us communication skills or how to help to balance a checkbook, you know? I believe that you learn how to love by loving people poorly, you know, or well, you know, like that you learn relationships by being in them. And maybe that's why we end up hurting each other so bad forever.
So through mistakes, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, that's true of everything, right? Yeah. But I do believe I will be 30 in June. And I believe I am the most emotionally competent as I have ever been this year, and yet I've been dating people for the past 10 years.
Right.
I'm so sorry, people in my past.
It takes 10,000 hours to get really good at something.
Yeah, and I don't know. Just in terms of like true, authentic emotional connection and communication, in which you're understanding that people are human and sometimes broken and sometimes are bringing their own things to the table, to truly understand that with a ton of foresight takes a lot of years and a lot of bad relationships.
And you mentioned turning 30 a few times in this interview.
Am I prepping myself?
Yeah, it's like it's a metaphor. It's like it's next, you know, like.
Yeah. If you haven't noticed, I've dyed my hair a Targaryen silver, and I had always wanted to do that. And then like 2 weeks ago, I was like, oh, I'm going to be 30. I can't do it after I'm 30. You know, it's a precipice, really.
Yeah. Heidi, you should get a, you know, poet 30 under 30 list started so that.
Yeah, quick. Yeah, for
exactly.
I'm happy to turn 30. I love my life now more than I've ever have.
Yeah. That is a perfect way to close this interview. Thank you. This has been a true pleasure. Where can, you know, for people listening now, then people also, you know, hear this on the podcast, where can people learn more about you? Where can they find you online? Where can they learn more about your work?
Yeah. Again, my name is Sierra Mulder. You can find me on all social medias except for Snapchat, at my name. And you can find my brand new book at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or your local bookstore. If you are in the Midwest, specifically in Minnesota, I have a book release show celebrating this book on Saturday, February 6th at 7 p.m. at Honey. If you follow me on Facebook on my professional page, I'll be posting about it. Also, if you are a high school student or you know a high school poet who is an incoming freshman to an outgoing senior, I run a summer poetry slam writing camp for high school students. It's an annual weekly camp, and it's my favorite week of the year, and we're just going to start advertising. It'll be our fifth year, but we're just going to put up our new website soon, so keep your eye out for that. And I think that's it. Perfect. Thank you so much, Eric. Thank you so much, Internet.
Yeah, we'll make sure to feature that as well. Thank you so much, and have a great rest of your day. The book is Today Means Amen, and so excited for everything that's upcoming.
Thank you. Thank you so much.